Hello, everybody. This is a bit of a pre-intro that I'm recording the next day after we recorded the podcast. In the main body of the podcast, we refer to Vince McMahon as probably never going to retire from WWE. We actually recorded it several hours before Vince McMahon then retired from WWE publicly on Twitter, so we were a bit wrong on that one. On the WSI YouTube channel, which you can find the links to in the description of this podcast, Dutch and I do two separate emergency breaking news videos, one on Vince retiring and one on Brock Lesnar leaving SmackDown. And then we could have done a third one as well if I wasn't asleep with Brock Lesnar returning, but we didn't do that one. So if you want to know more about that, then head to the WSI YouTube channel. Otherwise, enjoy the podcast. Hello, everybody. It's James here, and this is Storytime with Dutch Mantel. And we're going to do some plugs first, and then we're going to go straight into it. Storytime with Dutch, available at Amazon. Tales from a Dirt Road, available from Amazon. Owen Hart, King of Pranks, available from Amazon. And The Rock, I always forget what this is called, The People's Champion, available at Amazon. It's awful that I forgot the name of my own book.
You did not do that.
I did actually just look at it.
You did?
Yeah, because it's got two titles. I always want to say from WWE to Hollywood. So, Dutch, how are you doing? We're doing this a couple of days late.
Oh, we are because of an accident on your end. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have knee problems. Now you have knee problems. So that could be your payback, your karma, for even talking to me. Now you got a knee problem. Yeah.
You like osmosis as a word, don't you? Maybe I'm catching it through osmosis or sort of like microwave.
Osmosis. I learned that word one time and I never forgot it for some reason. And every time I use it, which is rarely, I say, hey, that's a pretty good word, right? And they say, oh yeah, osmosis is the effect of being just around something. Osmosis, so. That's for the ones that don't know. But anyway, I'm doing good. And as far as my books go, you can order them through Amazon, but you can order them directly through me too. If you want them personally autographed, it's a little bit more, it's about 10 bucks more, but, and you can contact me, dirtydutchmantel@gmail.com. And I'm having my newly re-engineered website opening soon, and that is dirtydutchmantel.com.
I will.
So, and that is like, it'll have a blog section on it too, where all of I put all my stories. So if you just want to read some wrestling stories, you can go over there and read it. Plus I'll have some merchandise up. And my University of Dutch diploma that you can get, that's like 30 bucks. You
I'm know. Still waiting for mine.
Well, you didn't give me your address.
I did. I've emailed you my address many emails ago.
I guess I'm a liar now. You did not. Did you give me your address, really?
Somewhere I did, but that was a couple of weeks ago. So it's lost in the ether somewhere, I think.
Well, you know me now. You gotta just slam me with it. Or it's lost. Yeah. But anyway, it's a University of Dutch official diploma. And that if somebody comes in and you're arguing a wrestling question and you say, where did you get your diploma from? They said, well, I didn't get one. You said, well, I do. Right there, pointed out on the wall, university. And your name is prominently displayed on it. And it's actually a very nice diploma. It looks very, very official too, by the way. I put the stamp on it and the whole deal. And I sign it. The dean is Dirty Dutch Mantel, and the provost, I guess, of the university is Zeb Coulter. So actually, you get two autographs on it. That's not too bad, I don't think.
Is the custodial engineer Texas Dirt?
Well, yeah, but I couldn't put that on there, but I could add it. It takes a little more engineering. I could add Texas Dirt on there. And Texas Dirt's a great story, you know, so, but let's get on with this podcast because I know you got some great questions and I'm dying to talk. See, we had scheduled to do this Wednesday. And what happened Wednesday?
Well,
see, I can't even remember 2 days ago. This is Friday, everybody. So but we had scheduled to do it two days ago.
Right. So the story goes is originally we record these on Tuesdays. We had a heat wave. And no one in this country believes in air conditioning. So I was like, do you know what? I just can't do it. and I've got a south-facing window, so it was just going to roast me. So we ended up moving it to Wednesday. And then on Wednesday, you couldn't make it because you were having a heat wave, and then you had a really important phone call as well, and the guy hadn't rung you. So we ended up sort of just putting it off. And then so we've come to Friday, but on Monday, just gone, I had a accident, and I wasn't going to mention this until I actually posted a couple of videos of Road Dog about an hour before we record this. And several people have said, is that road rash on your arm? And I was like, yes, it is. So the story is, and it's not even a cool story, I've got a road rash from like one of the lamest like transport, like modes of transport there ever was. So I've got this overly powerful electric scooter. I don't know how prevalent they are in Florida or the United States in general, but they're everywhere here. And I wasn't going particularly fast, 15, 20 miles an hour. And without knowing it, the handlebars went like that. The scooter stopped and I kept going. So I ended up landing on my right-hand side. I've torn my meniscus at least. That's all we know at this point. I've got to go to the physio to see what else I may have torn. Bit of road rash, that doesn't matter. But also I've fractured my hand slightly as well. So I've got the added joy of not only not being able to walk anywhere, I can't use crutches either because I keep pressing on this this hand to use them. So I had, and we found out the reason why the handles went and just 90 degrees for the audio podcast listeners, was there was a grey piece of like rubber coated wire that was quite thick on the road. Didn't see it, somehow got caught up in the wheel, jammed the wheel, and the wheel just turned. So I ended up getting scraped off the roadside a few days ago by a very nice stranger, in fact, got the spatula out, scraped me up, put me on the side of the road, and I got sort of dragged back. So this is going to be me not walking for a few weeks, apparently.
You're lucky. You're very lucky.
Yeah.
So, and you're lucky you didn't hit your face.
I did. But, and because it was so hot, this was on Monday, so the heat wave was happening, and I was like, do I want to wear a helmet? Because it'll itch my head. And and I chose yes. And thank goodness, because I looked at the helmet afterwards because I smashed my head on the floor. Not a problem. Head's fine.
Wow.
Neck's a bit jacked. That's it. And I looked at the helmet as well, and it's got loads of scratches down it. So I must have like whoosh, dragged myself straight across the road. But yeah, luckily I wore it, and I'll never not wear it again. It's like a motocross helmet. It's really good quality as well. So there you go. Good.
Well, let's start the podcast that you're okay, and we're all happy about that. And I'll tell you some of my accidents one day, but not right now.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, one of the questions will relate to injuries, and I will ask you about your injuries as well. But the main thing of the last couple of weeks, and this was happening just after we stopped recording 2 weeks ago, so it's a bit old hat now, but Vince McMahon and the other NDAs. I'm going to read you the later report from the Wall Street Journal, and this was 8th of July it came up. Vince McMahon paid out $12 million to three former employees. Now, since I don't have my glasses on, I'm going to have to lift it up a bit. One woman, a former wrestler, said that McMahon coerced her into giving him oral sex and then demoted her and ultimately declined to renew her contract in 2005 after she resisted further encounters. She agreed to a $7.5 million pact in 2018, so 13 years later. And is there anything else to add? No, she signed the NDA and she's staying silent about the agreement. We'll tackle this one first. It could be any number of people, but I've heard one name in particular. We will not say the name, but your reaction to that one first.
So she got $7.5 million later.
Yes.
And signed an NDA then?
Signed an NDA in 2018 after the settlement was agreed upon, I believe.
Wow. That is crazy. Now, it must be true, or why the NDA? Mm-hmm. And all I can say is that I hated that she was caught in that position, but she was compensated well, I might add, for that. So, I don't think she's carrying any, because I can't speak for her, any lifelong scars, mental scars or emotional scars. because those financial scars might make up for that. I think $7.5 million on something that happened 13 years ago, that kind of cheered me up. So you can kind of put that 13 years ago, what happened physically, you can kind of put that in the back of your head and enjoy the $7.5 million. There's really nothing to be said for it because it had to happen, or Vince would have no reason and his legal team would have no reason to settle with her. So why do you think they settled with her? She was going to go public with it?
Quite potentially, yeah. And I always find it amazing that the NDAs that somehow the Wall Street Journal has got a hold of actually lists the reasons why. I mean, maybe they have to list the reasons why, or the reasons, or the things that the person signing the NDA cannot say or reference to. But I mean, it's pretty detailed.
Well, I haven't read that, but I would like to read it. So how can I read it?
You'd have to pay a subscription to the Wall Street Journal
Did they list it?
Well, I mean, what I've said there is the shortened version of it. I don't think they've said too much beyond that. They've not sent they've not published the contract or the non-disclosure agreement. They've given a synopsis of.
Crazy. That whole situation with Vince and with John Laurinaitis, it's crazy. And I think you were going to ask me something about 2012 with Laurinaitis.
I will, but just before I do, I'm going to give you the other two NDAs that were revealed on July 8th. Another case involved a WWE contractor who shared unsolicited photos of a man with the company and said that he harassed her on the job. She and McMahon agreed to a $1 million payment in 2008, along with her non-disclosure agreement, and the last of the three. And this basically could only be maybe one person. We won't say the name. A former manager said that McMahon initiated a sexual relationship with her after working with him for 10 years. In 2006, they agreed to a $1 million payout for her to stay quiet.
Wow, that Vince is a horny little bastard, is all I can say. But like when I went there in 2000, when I was there in the 90s, and they were taught then of, you know, little Twitters over here and little Twitters over there, and about from the girls, and you know, females like to talk anyway. And then if you get one of the divas, you know, just in conversation, just talking, they would bring that up. All you'd have to do sometimes is say, hey, what happened between so and so? And you didn't even have to say Vince's name. They know what you're talking about. And I went, and they'd look around, see if anybody was listening. And then now you get all the gossip. And of course, it's the same thing. Yeah, they've had this thing going on. And, you know, he hits on a lot of girls. And now that's what they're saying. I don't know. I'm just hearing this. But when I got there back in 2012, nothing had changed really. Because John Laurinaitis, when I got there, was not there. And of course, I didn't know many of the divas then, but I got to know them later, you know, because we would make trips to Europe and on those long plane flights, and they get a cup of wine, toddies in them, and some beer, and then they start talking. Yeah, he was released. I think John Laurinaitis was not let go, but kind of put on suspension and sent home. Because of his proclivity, I guess, to talk to the divas, and that was common knowledge. So it's one of those things you step into, you can't change it, nor did what I even try to even offer anything, because it's not my place. I'm just hearing the stories and seeing how the divas were dealing with it. And after I hear $7.5 million, they dealt with it pretty good, I think. So, but are those days behind WWE? Well, I think they're behind WWE as far as Vince is concerned. But I don't think, and I've said this before, I don't think Laurinaitis will find his way back there. I just don't. I think there's he's toxic. And after several times, I think if he and they can't trust him not to do it again. And by the third time, no telling what this settlement would be if they let him back, because they already knew of his previous behavior and yet hired him back. And they would have some reckoning to do with just that fact there.
Well, they say that time heals all wounds, or time, you know, makes people forget. So obviously they thought they could bring him back after a certain amount of time and get away with it.
Our time and $7.5 million. Mm. That can heal a lot of wounds too, and hurt feelings.
Someone wrote this on a comment, and I thought, man, I hadn't even thought about this. Like, just with these three NDAs, in fact, we could add the other one in, so that's $3 million. So $15 million is, off the top of my head, six times more than what Vince paid for WCW.
Yeah. It's crazy. It really is. So when you're thinking about how much the WWE is worth now, estimated $5 billion, that's quite a price for us for an endeavor that actually started in high school gyms. And we can thank Vince for bringing it out of the high school gyms and the small arenas and putting it in stadiums. We can thank him for that. And he is the one who made it mainstream. But a lot of thanks can be given to him, but nobody's perfect. So he got in a little trouble. He's a little naughty boy. So I don't know.
He'll survive.
$7.5 million, but $15 million if he can afford it. Keep going. Hell, I'm almost sad I wasn't transgender when I was there. Can I say that? I missed a payday.
I think Vince McMahon will survive it.
I think he will too. I really do.
Actually, just before we move on, I'm going to add in one more thing, and this is something just amusing to me, is Vince McMahon actually wanted to bump the salary of the initial paralegal who he hired and then kicked down to Johnny Ace from $100,000, which is already a lot for a paralegal, to $300,000, and people advised him not to because it looked too suspicious. So he stuck to $200,000 for the pay rise for the paralegal, which was still too much and raised tons of eyebrows.
I liked your term bumped. He would want to bump the pay up. So that was a very good word to use in that. Yeah, but see, I said one time when it happened, well, it was his own money. Well, that's what they're determining now, I think. Was it WWE money or was it his money? If it's his money, I don't know, it may be a different story, but it can't be his money if they were on salary. Because he would have to actually be paying the paralegal, and he wasn't doing that. WWE was paying the paralegal. So using company money is an offense. But I think Vince is still protected because he owns 80% of the voting shares. So who's going to vote him out? He's not going to vote himself out. And, you know, Stephanie's not going to do it, or Triple H or anybody. They're not going to do it. So and that's why he walked on to Raw the other week, like nothing had happened, and I'm not going anywhere. And I don't know.
I was going to say, Linda might vote him out, though.
Well, she would probably. Well, I doubt if she'd do it either. She may be mad at him. I don't think she's that mad at him. I really don't. Now, it's been a couple of years, I didn't hear this till lately that Vince and Linda haven't been together for a couple of years. Mm. And I didn't even know that, because there's no need for me to know it. Really, it's none of my business, nor is it anybody else's business, whether they're together or not. But I'm thinking back, when all this other stuff happened, what was Linda's reaction to the first one, like the referee, the woman referee, what's her name?
Rita Marie Chatterton.
Chatterton. I wonder what her reaction was to that. Couldn't have been good. And what was Stephanie's reaction to it?
Well, she would have been a little child back in 86. I don't think she would have had a reaction.
Well, she may have watched her mother.
Mm.
She'd had a reaction to it. And what is her reaction to it now? Who knows?
I'd love to
know. I think those millions of dollars make a difference in how you view things. I really do.
I will ask a couple more on this because I know I'm harping on it, but you always give great answers to everything, so I sort of have to. Back with Johnny Laurinaitis, 2012. You said you heard twitters of what happened. I mean, name redacted, but do you know at least vaguely why you think he was let go? What specific incident it was?
I don't know. And if I didn't, well, they may have said, I've kind of forgotten. But it was, your knee seems to be really bothering you.
Yes, it was. I was moving it off a footstool very slowly.
Okay. But it was just, it wasn't necessarily, the gossip wasn't necessarily about one. It was about several. And I guess this is when John was still single and he was hitting on all of them. And it was common knowledge. So, and they let him go. And like I said, they didn't let him go. They put him on suspension, but it was common knowledge. But when I was around him, I still heard like pieces and parts that he was resorting back to his old ways. And whether he was or not, I don't know. It's that little twitter in your ear. John's at it again. John's at it again. So.
Oh, it makes you wonder about the Diva search that just so happened to come in 2004, but we will leave it there. And we will go to the next one. And this is slightly Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was about to just read the exact same thing. Am I? Yes, I am. So we'll move on to some of the biggest news hitting WWE at the moment. And this is Raw. And pay-per-views as well, maybe reportedly moving to TV-14. What do you think about that, and how do you think it will manifest itself in the product?
Actually, I'm dreading it because the writers, before when all this started, Vince Russo kind of did it. And it was kind of when it was new and it was kind of sophomoric. But some of his stuff was okay. The Jerry Lawler doing the puppies deal. It was, wasn't even sophomoric. That's more like eighth graderish. So, and I never, but that's not even that bad, but that's when you remember when they had, I think it was it Edge with some girl and they had a bed in the ring.
Yeah. It was Lita 2006, the live sex celebration, and it went wrong. And, you saw a bit of booby for a brief minute.
Well, it's not a hell of a rating anyway.
Mm.
But I think now when you're going back to it, I'm thinking, where did this come from? Did it come from USA Network or did it come from Kevin Dunn? I think Kevin Dunn probably started it because he remembers the Attitude Era. And what they will do to try to like reinvent the wheel, I don't know what they're going to do. I'm kind of anxious to see it, but I'm also kind of saying it could be horrible. I mean, I don't know if they can even do it. How can you even do with the stuff that you can see on TV now? That would be just like joining the rest of TV. I mean, it's nothing different anymore, or even cutting edge if you're joining everybody else. So, and I still think there's a lot of kids that watch it because the Attitude Era lost some viewers too. They gained a lot, but they lost a lot of viewers because of people didn't want their children, their kids watching this. The only thing, and they may just do that TV-14 or PG-14 after 10 o'clock. On the East Coast, they have an extra hour to get it in. So I don't know if it's going to affect them. I don't think it's going to have that big of effect on them anyway. I really don't, because they're not making their money. They're making their money off TV. I got that. But they also, you know, they posted almost $1 billion profit last year, and most of those without live events. So it remains to be seen. I'm going to watch it and see. It does pique my interest a little bit.
I think my theory, or I've heard this theory being said, is that they're actually trying to catch it with AEW, because I don't know if they're TV-14, but apparently on every single show, or at least on Dynamite, someone says shit. And I think maybe WWE wants to say shit.
Well, I do think AEW, and on Friday night on that Rampage show, they cuss like sailors sometimes. And I'm saying, well, maybe they're trying to say AEW is not ahead of them in that department. So, I do SmackDown every week on the Sportskeeda Network. And every week, if it's like 2 hours of SmackDown, then I watch an hour of Rampage. And I think Rampage has been beating SmackDown as far as content. Because if you're tuning in for the wrestling, Rampage has a lot more wrestling than SmackDown does. SmackDown hardly has any. And you can almost pick, they're going to open with an in-ring, because they've been doing that for like 20 years. You're going to open with the in-ring and hit a go to 14 minutes or 15 minutes past the hour. And then you go to commercial, then you come back. And right before it ends, you'll see the next team coming out or the next match. You'll see the participants in that parade to the ring. And then you come back, and you can almost predict exactly what order the wrestlers are going to be in. It'll be New Day versus whoever they've been running with. It was the Lotharios for a while. They'll do this for 4 or 5 weeks. And you can predict it, and you can almost predict who's going to win. So, but people still, I guess, keep watching it, because I think SmackDown's viewing, the fans tuning in, is actually better than Raw's. Yes or no?
Yeah, but they are also on a stronger network as well, even though they're on a worse day.
And they're on, and they come on at 8 o'clock, but so does Raw. Raw comes on at 8. And I think Rampage would be doing better also, but they come on at 10 o'clock, which is late for a primetime show to be on. But they're still doing right at 1 million viewers. But I'm comparing. I used to work for TNA. TNA did 1 million viewers, and when it got below 1 million, everybody was bitching and moaning, and they wanted to fire everybody. Spike TV, to get 1 million viewers on that little crappy channel we was on, it wasn't really that crappy, but it had a pretty good show. But we did 1 million viewers back in the day, it was in early 2000s. We'd do 1 million viewers, and they would be disappointed, because Dixie Carter, I'm not saying anything bad about her, she somehow had it in her head that we could challenge Raw or WWE. I think it was still WWE.
It would have been WWE, yeah.
Yeah. That we could challenge them for, the wrestling title, I guess. And there was a war going on, they said. But, for a war to be declared, one side has to actually know that a war is going on. WWE never knew there was a war. They didn't care. They just kept chugging it out. And TNA kept chugging it out. So, and the only ones who actually were debating this is like the same ones today, the wrestling addicts, I call them, that want to compare the two shows. And there is a comparison to be made, but it's according to which one you like the best. If I had to choose between watching, and there's a reason for this, if I had to choose between watching SmackDown and Rampage, I'd watch Rampage, because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what glitch bot you're going to see, because they obviously don't have an editing department, so you're allowable to see anything, and it's only an hour. See, I can watch an hour show. to watch a 3-hour show like on Raw. And I know I'm talking about SmackDown, but to watch a 3-hour show for me, that's a commitment. I mean, if I see a movie and it says running time or 3 hours, guess what? I don't watch it because I don't know I want to be there for 3 hours. And especially, you know, after an hour and a half, you go, God, I got another hour and a half. I'll be gone. But Rampage, you can kind of watch it. It's an hour. It does have, you know, decent wrestling, pretty good wrestling. And even though I don't call some of the stuff that they do wrestling, it's still more, you know, performance art, they like to call it. And it is that. But wrestling today, it is so different than wrestling of, say, when I started. The only commonality between either styles is a ring. That's the only thing that connects them sometimes. Because wrestling of old, you know, we told a story, or we tried to tell a story, because the wrestling wasn't that great. But if you had a story, it's like watching a football game, a United States football game. It's a defensive battle back and forth. Well, you can start following that story. But today in wrestling, who knows? They just sing. And they did make a mistake not too long ago. You know, that Wardlaw, that guy that they're pushing.
Yes.
Is that his name?
Yeah, Wardlaw, yeah.
They put him out there with Orange Cassidy. And here's this big, strong guy that's supposed to be indestructible, and Orange Cassidy was just beating the crap out of him. And it to me, it did a lot more damage to Wardlaw than it tried to help Cassidy. Cassidy is what he is. He's a comedy guy, and he's actually good in the ring. But if you're trying to push, it's like trying to put a road warrior in there, and he's in there selling for damn, what's the little Dudley's name?
Spike.
Selling for Spike Dudley. It didn't make sense. Yeah. But anyway, that's my rant for the day.
Well, do you know what? Why don't we stick with the Wardlaw thing then? Because I've heard even the most ardent supporters of AEW just going, what the heck have they done with Wardlaw the last few weeks? Because he seemed to be having some sort of Goldberg-esque run. And then they pitted him against, like, what, 30 orderlies or something like that, which were just like local indie guys. And everybody farted on that. And now he seems to be going toe-to-toe with somebody half his size.
Doesn't make sense. Because you expect to say, here's this guy, he's 260 pounds and chiseled up like he's been sculpted out of stone. And you put him in there with a guy like Orange Cassidy, which is a more or less a halfway comedy character. And he has his fans too. But to have Wardlaw like on the receiving end of Cassidy's offense, it just, like I said, it did damage to Wardlaw. It did. So if you're going to have a strong character, he's got to be strong, especially in that situation. And since he wasn't, you look at it and you don't, it's like you leave your fan saying, I mean, a strong fan saying, what the F is going on here? Even if they noticed, even kids noticed, like, you know, they give him that look like, what the heck is, what happened to Wardlaw? I didn't know Orange Cassidy was that strong. And I don't know, this is one of the things you got to remember when you're trying to book something. And I don't know how that went through a booking committee. I don't know how it got past Tony Khan, what he was doing, or he even realized what he was doing. Unless he had some event or some scenario down the road that he was trying to lean to. I can't make sense of it.
Do you know, this is, I've not written this down at all, but I want to ask you, is back in TNA, there seemed to be their own version of Goldberg for a while, or at least attempted to be, and it didn't really work out. And it was a guy called Relic, that's killer spelled backwards, as Mike Tenay would remind you 10 times every single match. Do you remember what the idea with Relic was and what they ultimately were hoping he would be?
I'd have to think back on that. I can't even hardly remember Relic. I remember the name and the spell backwards, but, and who was it? I can't even remember who it was now.
I don't remember him. I don't know if he's still in the business or not. Don't know.
I don't think so. Yeah, there's nobody in the business now because it's all changed over. But he was supposed to be this, you know, an indestructible guy. And then all of a sudden he was indestructible till he wasn't. And then I think he just stopped making TV. I forgot what happened there.
Do you know who he was? It was Johnny Stamboli. He was in WWE, I think, is like one of the FBI guys. And then he went to TNA and became Relic. That's Killer Spell backwards. And then never heard from him again.
Well, I don't know. Don't ask me anything about TNA, because I should have been on heavily, you know, hallucinogenic drugs, because I don't remember most of TNA. I really don't.
Well, if we can somehow convince Road Dogg to come on this story, it may be quite a lot of TNA questions, but we'll move on from that. And we'll go to Matt Jackson of the Young Bucks suffering a stinger on the July 14th AEW Dynamite. You don't watch Dynamite, but essentially it was a double vertical suplex, and he either over-rotated slightly or something. He's got a history of neck problems. His neck went out straight away. But what I'm going to ask you is, what is going on with AEW's injuries lately? I mean, some of them are going to be from high risk. Others just because they're not getting enough reps in the ring, maybe?
Well, I don't think they work every day. That's what it is. Because say you work a TB match, but you don't have any matches booked for the next week or to the next TV. You could go 2 weeks without even going into a ring. So most guys, once they start, they don't go down to the ring to practice. They don't do that. They lay at home or they go out or whatever. And they don't see the ring to the next TV. And after a while, that builds up, because after you take a couple of weeks, and some guys may take a month off, they're not seeing a ring too much. Believe me, that then your body gets in there. Your body's has got used to not taking those bumps, not taking those moves, and you can get hurt. And it's what I'm surprised at. Some of these moves these guys want to do is almost death defying. And some of them are still alive, and I don't even understand this. One of the most stupidest, is that a word, stupidest?
It is now.
Was when, what's that kid's name?
Darby Allin.
He did the dive from the top of the ladder. And I may have talked about this before. He did a dive from the top of the ladder, sat up in the ring, maybe not in the middle, but close to the rope. And he was going to dive out on top of Jeff Hardy laying on some chairs. What surprised me is Jeff Hardy agreed to take it. And then I don't know how Darby talked him into doing it, because that could have been very easily an injury or even possibly a death if your head had hit somewhere. And for what? For 5 seconds of TV? I don't get to some of the moves these guys take. I saw a guy jump off a top of a cage, this independent show somewhere. And he was going to do like a double back, you know, the swan dive on a guy laying on a chair or sitting on a chair. And he missed. And he hit the guy in the head with his boot, knocked him out. He almost knocked himself out. There was like 50 people in the audience, and why he did it, I have no idea. Because what is the return on that? Death? I mean, you're not going to make enough money. I mean, even to pay you, if you get hurt, you're not going to make enough money to even pay your hospital bills. And if your insurance company found out that you were doing that jump, they would probably cancel your insurance and not pay for anything. I don't get it. That's why I'm saying the business today is so far different from the business that I broke in on. It's night and day. The only commonality between them is the ring. If you told me back in when I started, well, we need you to get on the top rope and jump on this guy that's laying on the floor and try to do this, I said, you got to be shitting me. I'm not only no, but hell no. I wouldn't even jump off the second rope. That's much too dangerous for me. But I still made a living, had great matches, and we told a story, and but you don't have that storytelling anymore. It's bing de bing de bing de bing de bing de bing, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Now, some of these guys, like the Jacksons we were just talking about, they have great matches. I mean, it's nonstop. But there's no, they don't sell anything. Nobody sells nothing. I don't know. I think the only thing, they wouldn't even see him if he pulled off a 12-gauge shotgun and boom, shot the guy. Well, he'd kick up and drop kick you or do a super kick. So if you're not going to sell anything, why even do it? That's the part of the business I do not understand today. And I'm sure you just interviewed Road Dogg, right?
Yep.
He'd be one of the strongest proponents of it. And Jeff Jarrett would be one of the strongest. Even Ric Flair, all of them would say, come on, guys. We got to have some part in the match where you sell something to give me time to walk around and get some heat on you. Otherwise, I don't know. I mean, that seems to be my answer now to a lot of questions is, I don't know. And I don't know.
Road Dogg said pretty much the same thing. And, you know, he was a producer and writer for many years and did every, you know, WWE and maybe TNA as well. I want to ask you this, actually. WWE is to a point with COVID and concussions, but why is AEW even more secretive about the nature of the injuries that all these wrestlers are suffering? They seem to not want any information released at all.
You're asking why?
I am, yeah.
I thought I made myself perfectly clear in the previous segment when I said, I don't know. And that's another one that I don't know. I mean, why don't they release? WWE releases it. But see, he doesn't have to release it because, see, WWE, let's take SmackDown. They have the same people every week for multiple months in a row. So all of a sudden, one of the luchadors gets hurt. Well, and he can't be on TV. He can't work. Well, you might as well release it because that's why he's not there. He's hurt. But AEW doesn't follow that formula. And I kind of do. I like their formula because you're not going to see one guy wear his welcome out on AEW. I like to see new guys. That's how you get them over. Put them on TV, see the reaction to them, because that's the way I used to book. Because I would take a guy that, say, the crowd hasn't seen in a live show, and that's where you test them and you try to try them out. But if they react to this guy or lady, a girl, and they've never seen them, well, they got something. So you got to make a mental note. Well, the crowd reacted to Jim or whatever his name is, and they'd never seen him. So if they reacted to him the first time, what if we did something with him? Can we kind of take that cheer tonight and amplify it and build it up? So that's what I would look for. But I don't think they release their injuries because you don't see them multiple weeks in a row. So there's really no need to, but I don't know why they don't do that.
That's a bit of a mystery. I'll move on and I'll ask you about, can you remember maybe one or two of the worst injuries you ever suffered in the wrestling business, and what was the cause and who was to blame?
I took a big backdrop one time, and I don't know how many people know this nerve, sciatic, you know it. Mm-hmm. And somehow that sciatic nerve got twisted. And if you've never had a sciatic nerve, you can do it sitting down. It's a very common, I don't even know if it's an injury. It's just a nerve displacement, but you cannot walk. It hurts that bad. If you hurt your sciatica. But I remembered I was hurt and I told the guys, I said, I can't make the show. And they said, oh, you gotta make the show. I said, but I can't wrestle. I can't work. They said, oh, don't worry about that. We just want you to be there because we want the people to see you there. And they knew I was limping around, so the people would believe that I was legitimately hurt. And they just told me to go to the show and just walk out there, roll out there. I think I was in a chair, and I did a little promo. But at least I was there. People that bought tickets, and they announced first that I would not be wrestling, but the people, they came in anyway. But they wanted me there just to prove that we're not just lying to them. So at least they were truthful in that. And I don't remember really getting hurt that badly in a wrestling ring. One time I got my head ran into those big rooms where they have a separator in the middle and you can pull them closed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was in this little arena, it's outside Memphis, and where the door is locked, it was opened a little bit, and I was working with Bill Dundee. He ran my head into that lock, and I misjudged it, and I split myself right down through there. And I was bleeding like a stuck pig. And I remember Dundee looked at me and said, "Hey, mate." He said, "Great juice." I said, "Juice, hell, I'm dying here." I mate, you'll be okay. And so we finished the match. But that was mostly the extent of my, and even though that cut, it didn't cost me to miss anything, but I don't think I really got hurt that much. You know, when I think about, you know how many matches I've had?
Are we talking five figures here, or?
I don't think we're talking five, but we're talking four, high fours. I say, and I'm just trying to figure, and I can't figure it up. I say at least 5,000 or 6,000 matches that I've had, and I've watched probably 10 times that much. I've watched 60,000 matches probably. So when I look at a match now, it's got to be really something extra special to get me to rate it pretty high, because I've seen so many. But thinking about the number of matches I've had, I'm thinking that's crazy to have 6,000 actually. And how many do I remember? I remember I can go to a show sometimes and some guy comes up, "Hi, Dutch, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, yeah, you remember me?" Well, no, I don't. But I don't tell them that. I said, "Oh, yeah, how can I?" "And you are, and I'm Jim." "Oh, Jim. Oh, yeah, man. And you are from," and he tells me, fills it in. "Oh, I remember it, man." But there's no way to remember. I can't remember what I did last week, let alone remember somebody I may have seen 40 years ago or 30 years ago. So, but thank God for the fans, because without them, guess what I'd have had to do? I'd have had to go out and actually get a real job, actually get up, go to work, which I wouldn't mind that much. But after I would get there, the people that hired me would expect me to actually do something, like do some work, do something. And you know, that going to work at like 7 o'clock in the morning, I was more like a 10:30-ish guy, 11 o'clock. And then I'd want to leave about 2:30, no later than 3. I can deal with that, but they wouldn't let me have those hours. So I just stuck with wrestling.
Hey, that's why I've always been self-employed. I've been self-employed since I was 22. So I always like to set my own hours.
Well, that's the best way to do it. If you can do that, and I have too. And when I didn't like, and this is back in the day when they had 32 different territories, because if you got fed up with one, you picked the phone up, and whether they'd heard of you or not, the fact that you were actually working in Georgia and you wanted to go to North Carolina, the fact that you had a job in Georgia actually was your resume. They could easily check that. And they say, "Yeah, come on in." I've quit jobs and had another job before the day was over, because now you have, I wouldn't even say two major companies. You still have one. You used to have WWF or WWE and WCW. You don't now take the WCW out. AEW, I don't think qualifies as WCW level, but with 32 companies, you know, if you were only halfway good, you could get a job somewhere. You wouldn't be out of work. But now, you know, it's mostly independent work now, unless you work with the WWE. Even AEW guys, they qualify for independence because they don't have a regular schedule. Do they run a regular schedule or no?
AEW, I think there's certain house shows they run, but I don't know if they're irregular. I don't think they've maybe got, like, you know, three house shows every week, that kind of thing.
Well, hopefully they get there because the business could use it.
Can I ask you this then? So we're going with the territories here, and you said, hey, it's great, you can have another job by the end of the day if you quit Georgia to go to wherever it is. What else, maybe not the fans, but what else are the wrestlers missing from not having the territories anymore?
Well, first of all, is the place of employment. I mean, permanent employment. If you worked at WCW or even back in the territory days, you'd get a list and you'd say, Memphis, Louisville, Evansville, this, or in Florida, you'd be, you know, West Palm Beach and Tampa and then Miami and then Jacksonville and then Tallahassee. It was a regular, those towns ran 52 weeks a year. And in Georgia, the same way. Carolinas and Virginia, the same way. Tennessee, the same way. Texas, the same way. California, Oregon, all those territories, they ran certain towns on certain nights. And but they don't do that anymore now. And your question was, what are they missing? Well, they're missing, first of all, a job and a regular place to work, because that's how you learn. And you know, I was bitching a moment ago. Well, not bitching. I was just analyzing. Let me say that. I was analyzing that these guys don't know how to tell a story. Well, it's not all their fault, because in Memphis, you were there 52 weeks a year. So you would have to remember, wait a minute, Monday, 2 weeks ago, I did this. Last Monday, I did this. So you're connecting the two dates. So it has to, like, on a storyline, it has to fit. And then what I'm going to do on this Monday, it has to fit in there. It's like watching a movie and then all of a sudden they jump ahead and then they come back to where you are now. It's confusing. Plus, it doesn't make sense. So if you can't learn to tell a story that way, you're not going to learn to tell a story. And that's what the guys are missing now. They're missing the story aspect of wrestling. Because if I'm watching it on TV, and this is the way I booked in Puerto Rico, everything was always a story. I would always read, and I had a great editor, guys named Moody, great. And he taught it himself because he was a wrestling fan and actually turned out to be a great editor, which had a natural, his understanding of the business was storyline. And every week I would do a catch-up video of what you could miss the TV the week before because we catch you up on it. Don't worry about it. We'll catch you up. And so that's how we done such a great business, because I kept it all storylined. So you can see, and it's even like in Memphis, the people, and I'm talking about storyline, but it was so strong. People set their watch by Saturday morning wrestling. When it came on, they knew it was 11 o'clock. So if their watch said 10 to 11, well, it's not 10 to 11, it's 11 o'clock because wrestling's on. And they would set their clock by that. And a funny thing about Memphis, one year, I think it was 1982, it was the best year that Memphis ever had. We sold more tickets than Madison Square Garden did to wrestling, more tickets. And we ran, and they ran Madison Square Garden, I think, maybe 10 times that year, maybe 11. Of course, we ran Memphis a lot more often, but we sold like 400,000 tickets in Memphis. That's a lot of tickets. I don't care where you are. If you sold 400,000 tickets to a wrestling match in any city in a year's time, that's a lot of tickets to sell. But the interest was there. I think Memphis TV, and the people used to laugh at Tennessee wrestling, but we had to make a living every week. So we did a lot of wild and crazy stuff. And we had to keep those people interested, or we didn't maybe maybe not our check the next week wouldn't be good. It'd be probably half of what it usually was, but it was, I think Memphis TV was the best TV at some point in the business. It beat Atlanta, it beat Florida, beat Carolinas. It was great TV and fun to watch because we had a great announcer, Lance Russell, and some great talent.
I hope we can do some specials on Memphis. You know, in a future episode, we will move on to some more news. And you watched SmackDown, I think this was last Friday, so 7 days ago, but you may remember Liv Morgan versus Natalya. Supposedly, it was two people singing from different hymn sheets on that match. Do you remember it?
Liv Morgan versus Natalya.
Yeah.
On SmackDown. Well, I didn't think a match was that bad, to tell you the truth. Did you see it?
No. I'm very much giving you third-hand information here.
Well, Natalya's a great... She's great in the ring. I don't like her entrance that much because I think they focus too much on the aesthetic value of a wrestler's interest instead of the work in the ring. But she's from a wrestling family, and I thought the match was okay. She was trying to help this little Liv girl along. But Liv's, she's been in the business for how long? 7 or 8 years, nine more?
Yeah, she's been in for quite a few years, yeah.
Yeah, she's not new. And the book on her is still out. Because is she going to make it or not? But, and I think she will, because I think the people like her. I don't think she'll be a long-term champion. I think her ability to talk is limited. And she looks more like your little babysitter girl than she does look like a big-time wrestler. But, and there was a lot of talk given to Natalya leaving the ring after a finish.
Yes.
She just got up and walked out. Well, I think that's overblown too. It could have been a lot of things wrong. You know, and maybe Natalya may not be able to tell you this, but she may have had to go to the bathroom. Because I've had that too. And I mean, you know, that's one of the untold stories. You said, what happened? And there's been a few accidents in the ring too, but that would really, really be bad for Natalya. If she had to use the bathroom and she didn't quite make it. Oh my God.
I'm going to come back to that in a second. Hold that thought. Okay. I will just ask about the booking of Liv Morgan. They're now giving her the Miracle Kid moniker. It's like, why does WWE always insist on making their champion look like a lucky loser who happened to just, you know, look into a win or a title?
Well, it's not designed for that, I'm sure. I think it's just a name they want to put on to see if it takes off. I don't think it was put there to make her look bad, but they probably had some merchandise made in that name or that brand, and they want to see if they can sell it. So they got to get it out there. I don't consider her what do they call her? A miracle what?
A miracle kid, it seems to be.
Oh, the miracle kid. Well, that's kind of following the story, I guess, but I don't know why they did that.
Okay, let's forget about Liv Morgan. Let's talk about wrestlers shitting themselves in the ring. How many times? I take it that certain wrestlers would wear white trunks until it happened, God. And they never would again.
Yes. Well, I've seen it. The guy come in and, oh my God. Of course, we know we would kind of have a clue about what happened. Somebody would come dressed and said, oh my God, Bill shit himself in the ring. I would go, what, a match bad? He said, no, he actually shit himself on himself. Oh my God. And then we'd see him come in. He's embarrassed. He'd go into, he'd go into the toilet. He'd close the door because we said, man, you should have thought of that before you went to the ring. He hears all these comments coming from different parts of the dressing room. And It takes him a good week to live that down. Mm. So you say, well, actually, you shitting yourself was better than a match. That was the best thing in a match. But, oh, it's happened. It's happened several times to guys.
I might as well. I shit myself at a gig once. I wasn't even drunk or anything. You know when you just take a risk.
How does this podcast go from talking about Vince McMahon and NDAs?
Well, he shit the bed in a metaphorical sense.
So what were you on now?
I don't even know what I was. I wasn't on anything. I just took a risk with a fart, and it went all wrong. Going back on wrestlers who've shit themselves. Right, there's CM Punk who's admitted it. A few other people have admitted it. There's a rumor going around that Sid sharted in the main event of WrestleMania against The Undertaker. You were gone from the company by that point in early 97, but is that a rumor you've ever heard?
Well, I heard this too. Andre the Giant did it one time on Bad News.
Brown / Allen.
Yep, he did it on him, but he was doing his in the corner, sit down on him. Oh, my God. There's video of it somewhere. And can you imagine Andre having an upset tummy? Oh, well, and it just Bad News Brown. Is that his name? Bad News Brown.
Yeah. Yeah.
He had to leave, I think, before the match was over.
The match was at a count out, was it? Or disqualification. Maybe the referee smelt it and called for the bell.
Well, I guess it was a count out, whatever it was, but I'm glad it happened, but it was a good thing it happened in a non-title match, because the guy was, he was done at that point.
We will move on. You've turned purple. Oh, no, you're going back now.
Wait a minute. Okay. I have this light, and it has a short in it, and I was doing pretty well with it, and all of a sudden, and it's right when the connectors meet. I got to get me another one, because I'm not going to try to fix the cord, because I'll just throw this away. So,
we'll suffer you being slightly more purple than usual. We'll do a couple more bits of news. We will move, and then we'll close the podcast down. I'll probably skip the Ric Flair thing because I've talked about enough. The Great Khali slapped a toll worker while traveling through Ludhiana to Karnal, India. Any memories of the Great Khali?
Well, yeah, a few. But I watched that video that he was supposed to slap the worker. I didn't see it.
No.
Did you see it?
No, I think the guy must have started filming before or after and made the claim.
Because he was just arguing with a toll worker and then got out. And I said, oh, well, this is it. He's going to slap him out here. And he didn't slap him out there. Then he went back to the car. Then he kept showing a guy's face or something. And then you saw him get in the car and drive off. I said, what the hell? He didn't slap anybody. Yeah, the Great Khali was there when I was there. And I remember an interview I did with him. And I was going to ask him about, like, he was trying to be a citizen of the United States or whatever. And that was my whole deal, was, you know, the immigrants coming in and not knowing anything about the United States. And I remember I asked him this question. I says, all right, who's buried in Grant's tomb? It's an old joke. Even you know it. Who's buried in Grant's tomb?
I'm hoping it's Ulysses S. Grant. That's the only one.
Yeah. And he just looked at me and I said, see, you don't know it. And it got a big pop from the crowd because they knew the answer. And he just looked at me, and I didn't tell him I was going to ask that question. But I needed something for him to be stumped on. But I don't remember him a lot. I remember he would just sit in the dressing room by himself, like Andre would a lot. He didn't move around a lot. He would just sit down. And once he sat down, he was there. I mean, he would do a homestead on it. And guys would try to, I guess that he didn't actually work that much. when I was there. I think he worked against Jack a time or two, Jack Swagger, but I don't remember a lot of Mr. What was his name again? Ali?
Great Carly.
Carly.
I think he's like Dalip Singh is his real name. Did you ever sit and really look at his head one time? Because he's got a very interesting head.
I never found him that interesting for me just to sit and kind of watch the look at the contour of his head. What's wrong with his head? Everything?
It's an interesting head, yes. He's got an incredibly amazing chin. Yeah,
he does have an interesting face where it comes down, squares off. But he is a big son of a gun. He's a big bastard. I think how big is he? 6'3"?
Well,
I mean, 7'3"?
Yeah, something around that, yeah.
And he's every bit of that. And he's not very agile. What's he doing in India now? I heard he was running a school. He's going to run some shows.
I didn't look what he's doing now. I think he's still quite a celebrity in India. And since you do work for Sportskeeda, I've seen on Sportskeeda, when they interview WWE people, they do it in character for the Indian audience because they have kayfabe there still, and they say that everything is legitimate.
So when he does an interview, he does it in character?
I think he basically says, yes, I beat this guy up and, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, he stays within character.
Yeah, you know, I worked. Have you ever heard of staying with the India? It was called Ring Kicking.
This was a TNA thing, wasn't it?
TNA thing, damnedest thing you ever saw. But actually, good TV. You know how we got wrestlers for that, Indian wrestlers?
Yeah.
They did a casting call. I think Colors is the name of the channel. They did a casting call for wrestlers. Now, listen to this. I don't think a lot of people know this. Mm. So they got about, say, 12 to 15 Indian male wrestlers. I don't think we've had any female wrestlers, Indian. And none of them had any previous wrestling experience. And we had, I think, 5 weeks to go before we started taping and we started training them in India. We sent Savio Vega to India, him and Eugene. Remember Eugene?
Yeah, Nick Dinsmore.
You know, we sent them over there to train these Indian wrestlers. And I think they did a miracle in 5 weeks to make these guys even halfway presentable for a TV audience. So I was helping out. I was in creative. It was, and Jeff wasn't even with TNA. It was a separate branch of TNA that Jarrett headed. And I was with him. And I told him, I said, well, the American guys we get got to be able to manage a match and manage another wrestler. So we got great managers. And I remember our first match on Ring Kicking TV was an Indian wrestler. And this was his first match ever in front of people. And it was on TV. I've never seen that before ever. I'll never see it again. But he actually went out there and looked like he belonged. So it was actually, and we would go down there and we had 26 shows to do, I think. And we went in December for 10 days. We did 14 shows. And then we went home for the New Year's. Then we came back in January and did the remaining 12 or whatever we had. So, and that's how they did. And it drew tremendous numbers. The first show drew like, and I don't know, you know, they got a billion people there, 1.4 billion people, 1.4 billion. They said we did 20 million people on the first show.
Wow.
20 million. So, when I heard that number, I said, bullshit. We did it. And they said, you know, they got a billion people there. I said, oh, well, could have done it.
Yeah,
but they never ran a house show. They just ran TV, and we did it for, I think, 26 weeks or 20, yeah, 26 weeks. And then it disappeared and never came back.
Well, I was going to ask then. So apparently it had very good ratings. Did it, I take it was never a touring thing. It was in the same building every week.
No, the TV station Colors or the network, they wanted wrestling. They wanted Indian wrestling. They didn't want WWE. They didn't want any other wrestling they could get. They wanted Indian wrestling, and that's what we gave them. And it was a great color. You know, and they would let the people in for free. They would do a casting call for that too, for fans to sit in the, and they would cheer on demand. You know, they'd watch this guy and he'd raise his hands up and they would cheer, and they loved Scott Steiner. they were scared to death of Scott Steiner, legitimately, because he'd come out there and he would go at them and they would run. I mean, just crazy stuff.
I mean, I'm legitimately scared of Scott Steiner. You don't have to pay me to, you know, pretend to be scared or anything.
Yeah. But Scott, you know, I love Scott. I mean, his interview he did about the percentage of the chance of you winning, and he broke it down to percentages. I don't know where he came up with that, but it's one of the greatest interviews I ever heard. It was three people in the match. And so it got down to the part that the percentage of them beating him was like less than 1%. That's when he ended up with it. But it was a great interview. You remember that interview?
I remember it very vividly. It's astonishing. And I think someone actually worked it out. And somehow, even though the logic is ridiculous, the numbers actually somehow add up correctly.
Yeah, it was. I told him, I said, where did you get that? He said, oh, I come up with it in my car going something. That's where most great interviews come to wrestlers back in the day, was in the car, because they spent so much time behind the wheel or riding. That's where their ideas would come from.
Just because we brought up Scott, and why not talk about a bit, you hear these horror stories by the end of WCW, you know, he was attacking DDP and he was on roid rage and that kind of thing. But by TNA, I hear that he just completely mellowed out and he was really easy to deal with.
No. Oh. No, to me, he was.
Right.
Because Scott liked me. See, a lot of this, all this stuff you hear about people, it's according to who they're dealing with, too. Scott was always very, very respectful of me, because I helped him out when he first broke in and had some of his earliest matches. And so, you know, I never got on to him about anything. I would just give him suggestions or advice. I didn't holler at him or any, because I never holler at people anyway. You know, I've seen guys holler at other guys, why did you do this, you stupid bastard, blah, blah, blah. And I've told several guys, I said, don't do that. They said, well, he screwed up. I said, well, he may have screwed up, but he didn't do it on purpose. He did it because he doesn't know. Now, your job is to kind of teach him what not to do next time. But you, by screaming at him, you put that wall there. And now he may be a little bit scared of you. So I never, not that I would holler at Scott Steiner anyway, because if he got mad at me, then I'd have to run. But he respected me. But it's according to if he likes you or not, it's according to how, you know, he's going to act around you. But he was always great to me, and he was great at Ring of King. And anytime I've ever been around him. Oh, you asked me earlier an injury I had. It was from the Steiners.
Okay.
They gave me that clothesline off the top rope, which is not bad. It's when you land. And I landed, and oh my God, it almost killed me. And it wasn't them, because that was kind of the easiest part of it. But it was, you know, when I just, the way I landed, the sciatic is just all in positioning. So I had to be helped out of the ring.
God. When you say you had some of his earliest matches, are you talking in WCW or in the territory prior?
No, Memphis. See, that's what Memphis used to be. It used to be kind of a developmental territory. Because that's when guys would go, because guys could get booked there and they would kind of learn what to do, what not to do for 6 months. Stone Cold started there, kind of that in Texas. Undertaker started there. Shawn Michaels kind of started there. The Rock and Roll Express, because they were already in the business anyway, but they kind of got their stuff together there. The Fantastics, a lot, Sid started there. A lot of guys started there. So, but then when Vince started and he killed all the little territories off, then guess what? Where are these guys going to learn? Mm-hmm. Where am I going to get talent? So then that's when he came up with his own like little experimental developmental places. Like Memphis was one, Georgia was one before they took it to Florida. But I mean, he killed his own minor leagues off. So where's he going to get talent? And that didn't occur to him to after like a year that he'd run all the territories out of business. Now, where's this talent going to come from?
Exactly. We will do a couple more things. This is the thing I really want to know out of all the questions I've written down for you this week. Rocky Johnson, now
what a horny bastard.
I know, yeah. He's making Vince McMahon look like a, you know, he came from a convent, isn't he? Rocky Johnson, as we say, was putting it about a bit over his career as a wrestler over the years, about something like five of his illegitimate children and half-brothers and sisters of The Rock. I've turned up, DNA tests have confirmed it. I'd like to actually know more about Rocky Johnson, because I believe you were in Memphis at least when he was there during a few of his runs. Rocky is a person, Rocky is a talent, everything you know about him.
Well, I was in Memphis with him a long, long time ago. And we lived at a monthly hotel, but you could pay monthly there. And it was kind of a new hotel. It was okay. And he lived right down the hall from me, him and his wife, and little Dewey, which is Rocky, which is The Rock now. He was like 2 years old, maybe three. And I would see him outside the door. Didn't see him too much, but Rocky was a good draw, especially on the Memphis end. And he's working out all the time, quite naturally. And your question is how he was, his work was what it was. I mean, he didn't do anything that was, he'd do the shuffle, the Ollie shuffle, and he'd do the pop, pop, pop. And he had a great drop kick. So he at least utilized his, what he had, he used it to its fullest. You know, I never knew where he was from. I read recently he was from like Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
New Brunswick. I didn't even know that. Mm-hmm. So, and he got to the States, and I think I was in Florida with him, and I was in Memphis with him. But I was never in WWF with him and Tony Atlas. And I never knew about the the children. Of course, there would be no way that I would know unless I wanted to ask around. And then I read this article and I went, damn, this guy, he just didn't have girlfriends. He had like, I mean, it lasted a while.
Harems, it seems.
A what?
A harem or harem of girls all around the place.
Well, I call it harem. That's why we say it down south. But they were never together. See? But he would meet this woman and they would in one place. And then that would be, I guess, his queen in waiting. Then he would go somewhere else. He'd have another one. Then he would go somewhere else. He'd have another one. So I guess he had at least five women, because he had five kids. And so I think if you really told the truth about some wrestlers, they were several that were like that.
Definitely.
Because there's no way to check it. I mean, other than going off gossip, but they all came together to make this story. But you know what I thought one time? A great serial killer could have been a wrestler because he moves around all the time, especially a mask wrestler. That'd make a good story, wouldn't it?
I'm trying to think who it could be.
Yeah.
Mil Mascaris.
Could have been, but you hear about all these murders they've never solved. It could have been by a wrestler.
Yeah.
You know who else are big time serial killers too? Truckers.
Yeah.
Because they're always on the move.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we should be in law enforcement. We'd come in there and our whole deal is say, well, blame it on wrestling. Let's check to see what wrestlers were around and let's investigate them first because people, they won't have the creativity to do that. So, yeah, but Rocky, getting back to him, the women liked him quite naturally. He was a good talker, I guess. He was a star. And he had women all over the place. So, but what was Rock's reaction to this?
I think they reached him for comments and he did not comment. I mean, also, I don't think a lot of people know this, is that aside from Rocky Johnson putting it about a bit, is Peter Maivia actually had a second family with another woman as well. And Rock's got like a couple of like uncles or aunts or something like that. Or
what
half
the hell? Around. What's up with them damn Samoans? Not just all over the place. Hey, listen, it's a fact of life. Just because he's a wrestler doesn't mean he's gonna change up. But and wrestlers, you know, this is why wrestlers have, you know, like girlfriends in different places. Back then you could run like Memphis ran 52 weeks a year. So you was in that town at least once a week. And in Florida, you was in Tampa every Tuesday night. So if somebody wanted to find you or meet you, they just go where they know you're going to be. And you're there all the time anyway. It's almost like you're living there. So it was easy for women to meet wrestlers and wrestlers to meet women.
Can I ask then about Rocky again? I wrote a bit about Rocky, of course, in my book. It's on Amazon. I plugged it at the beginning. And the two things that seem to come up constantly is one, that he's described as a bit of a con man. And two, he was making a lot of money, especially for the time, about $150,000 to $175,000 a year in the 70s. That's a lot of money. And yet he never seemed to have any of it ever. How can one run through so much money and save nothing?
Well, say you make $175,000. Let's say I make $150,000. You're going to pay a lot of that back to taxes. So let's knock, say, $40,000 off that. Leaves him $110,000. Then he's got to live, and then he's got to travel, and he's got to do this, got to do that. And say he can save $30,000 or $40,000 a year. Let's say after 10 years, that's $300,000 or $400,000 saved. But say all of a sudden you hit a spell that you don't have any work. And then that $300,000 goes down to $250,000, and then it goes down to $200,000. And so it's not inconceivable that Rocky spent his money just to live. And, you know, once you get used to a certain standard of living, you don't want to go below that. And it's not inconceivable, but yeah, he spent his money just because there was like from 1990 to now, unless you had a steady job. And I don't think Rocky had that. When was he in WWE with Tony Atlas? It was in the 80s, right?
Yeah, 82, 83, 84. That was probably his last lucrative run. By the late 80s, he was probably, because he was in his 40s when he was having his probably best run in WWF.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the late 80s, he was sort of scrapping around in Puerto Rico. I think by the late 80s, maybe 1990, he didn't have a penny to his name and he was working as a truck driver or something to that effect.
That's where the money went. It's not inconceivable, you know. It is hard to say, well, he made so much money. What did he do with it? Well, he could have been paying some of it out to these women that he'd met along the way. And if he was sending money here and sending money there, but I bet his wife never knew about that. So, and I think Rock was disappointed because of his mother. because I think that he saw maybe a lot of things between his mother and his dad that he didn't agree with. You know, Rock himself was broke after college. Mm-hmm. He was broker than a, he was broke. And he came to Nashville and trying to get a start in wrestling. And there's another one that started in Memphis, because Memphis was one of the last territories still running after, I call it the purge, after Vince purged everything. And he just basically wiped wrestling off the map, except for him. But, and Rocky wanted to learn the business, and he came to Nashville, and because Nashville was the hub of Memphis. I don't know why guys lived in Nashville. I don't know why they didn't live in Memphis. I don't know. But I do remember that he was, and he mentioned this several times, that he didn't have any money. He wasn't making any money wrestling because the territory was terrible, you know. And he met this guy named Downtown Bruno, who was a, and I love Bruno. He was a little manager, and Sid, I met him when he managed Sid, this Downtown Bruno. And he let Rock stay at his apartment. And it was a rundown apartment in Nashville on the east side or whatever, you know. And Rock never forgot it. And then about a year ago, he saw Bruno and he said, I don't know how, they had a camera out there. They caught it. And he gave him a brand new Ford 150 truck. And Bruno cried. And I can see that, because Bruno, he's not working for WWE anymore. So I don't know what he's doing. So, but one thing about Rock, he didn't forget the people that helped him along the way. And he's still good at that, because he still remembers people that helped him, you know, get to where he is now. And he can probably just, I think he's got a really good heart and a soft heart, because he gives to people that need it. And you can't fault a guy for that, because I think he may have had a difficult upbringing, even though he tries to make it look a lot better than what it was. I know what it was. His dad was gone a lot, and his mother was trying to feed him and, you know, raise him, and with the dad not there. But I think he looks on the bright side of things, and that's probably one of the reasons for his success.
I think you're right there. With Harvey, right, in the WWF in the early 90s, Harvey Whippleman, Downtown Bruno, did he ever wear a wig? He seems to have very, very strange hair in the WWF. I don't know if he was wearing a sort of weird wig in Memphis or something at the time.
I think it was dyed. I think it was. But he was, you know, if you just met Downtown Bruno, or Harvey, as you call him, on the street, he was a weird little character. He wasn't threatening, but he would just, you know, especially when he wore his glasses, his dark horn-rimmed glasses. He was just, and I guess he was from New York or somewhere, because you can tell he was not from down south, but he was a great guy, and he's got a good heart too. He really does. He lives in Mississippi now.
It says here in Wikipedia, take it for what you will, Jackson, Mississippi, that's where he was born, apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, he wasn't raised there, I'll tell you that.
I think we're going to leave it there with Harvey Whippleman. We have talked for a good amount of time, a good podcast length, so I'm trying to think how we're going to end the podcast. I forgot how we do it. How do we end podcasts these days, Dutch?
Well, I don't know. We've had so much trouble this week getting this one done. How do we end it?
Well, I'll tell you
other what. Than we're going to be back next week at this time.
Yeah, we'll be back this next week at this time. So I'll tell you what, I'll do some plugs. There are books on the floor that I can't reach because it'll take me about 4 minutes. But if you want to listen to those plugs again, then listen to those plugs again. We are on YouTube. We are on the WSI channel. We are on audio on wherever you get your podcast audio. If you want to give us 5 stars on iTunes, please do. If you don't like the podcast, you know, keep your opinion to yourself, you negative Nancy. No one wants to have a 1-star review of a moaning person, do they? So I thought we'd close the podcast for. I thought we'd close the podcast now. Thank you very much, Dutch, for entertaining us, and we will catch you next week.
See you then.